In the past 18 months, if anything has happened and taught us is that employees crave an investment in the human aspects of work. People are tired and many are grieving. They want a renewed sense of purpose at their work. They want a social and interpersonal connection with their colleagues, with their managers. And they want to feel, you know, a sense of identity. Yes, they want pay, benefits, perks, etc. But what they want is to be valued by the organizations and their managers. They want a meaningful, if not in person, interactions that are not just based on transactions. Hi, I'm Karthik Krishnamurthy, and I'm the Vice President for Paradox APAC. And I'm joined in the Tiger Hall today by Charles Ferguson, the General Manager for Globalization Partners across APAC. Hey, Charles.
Hey, man.
Thanks for making time today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
Thank you. Charles, I've had the pleasure of working and knowing you now for a very long time.
Too long, perhaps.
Too long. And I remember you've always had this philosophy, and the day I walked into your office when you and I first worked, you said, always be hiring and always be talking, especially to, you know, people, to candidates, to talent, no matter where you are. So as you think about this black swan event that we're all living through, the highs and lows of hiring, you know, obviously everybody's remote work these days, heightened emphasis on diversity. Just to get your perspective to get started, how should, you know, business leaders, HR leaders, professionals just rethink or reinvent their overall hiring strategy in this new way of working?
I mean, it's a heavy question. And it's loaded with a bunch of opportunity. So let me frame for you a little bit of the advice that I've been imparting to some of the customers that we work with and just generally sharing with folks out in the industry. I think my dear departed old man used to say to me that common sense is not always so common, right? And I think it's an appropriate adage. I would suggest to you that we are in a position right now where the markets are certainly showing the green shoots and the signs of recovery. And it's a nexus point of recovery on the one side, and on the antithetical side, and the corollary, we have this kind of war for talent that's going on. And it's a pretty intense nexus. The opportunity that I'm referring to is inherently around particularly HR. Before I go into this HR diatribe, I want to preface by saying it is indeed the case that over the course of the pandemic, the HR function has been thrust in many cases from the back of the house where they had been relegated for various reasons, historical, to the very tip of the spear of how companies and the human capital in these businesses address what's been going on. And by that, I mean to say, you know, the HR organizations have had their members become doctors and psychiatrists and nurses and moms and dads and everything in between, right? And the unique opportunity that HR kind of, you know, I don't want to sound too sort of cavalier about it, but they're kind of obligated to take on is the fact that what we have been operating under the auspices of as businesses for the past, let's be generous and just say only the past decade, the values, the vision, and the mission that the company has set off to go and conquer, if they've been around for a while, is based upon an environment and circumstances that have fundamentally changed due to the course of what's happened most recently. And so therefore, it's a unique point in time to sit down with the team and say, hey, I firmly believe that the vast majority of the culture that's part of this company is still inherently true to who we are, but mentioning, and it bears out, a rational amount of effort to sit down and revisit our vision, our values, and our mission. So I think that's a fair exercise. The reason that I bring this up is because once you have that fundamental sort of cornerstone framed and defined and bought off on consensus, you then have the blueprint by which you can go forward and start to rewrite your job descriptions, to initiate new policies in the way that you manage your organizations, what talent looks like. And when you go out and start having conversations with candidates, you can be much more in tune with how the characteristics and skill sets of these particular individuals, how their personalities potentially fit in the new world that we're operating in versus this perhaps unintentional desire to go back in time to where we were even just 24 months ago. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. Look, you brought up a very interesting point, and you talked about this whole war for talent, which I think McKinsey coined, what, almost a decade or...
Oh, yeah, it's like 25 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, quite some time ago. But it seems to come back because, you know, a recent article that they just published, it talked about the whole concept of the great attrition or the great attraction. You and I have talked about the great concept of great resignation.
Yep.
Right? And, you know, companies really failing to understand the mindset of the employees. And like I said, you know, turning a relationship into a transaction. So as you think about how organizations need to change that mindset, a two-pronged question. Number one, how do you see the impact of people either removing themselves completely away from an organization or companies not being able to attract fast enough? How do you see long-term the impact of that on businesses and how they're supposed to solve for it, number one? Number two, how do HR organizations or HR leaders in these companies think about the speed of hiring while keeping in candidate experience in mind that's meaningful and long-term?
Those are two extremely heavy questions, man. Let me address them in order. So the first challenge that you call out is this McKinseyan sort of defined great attrition. Now, the reality is that multiple companies in the market, Microsoft, I think a couple of months ago, came out with a study about this. Several multinationals have come out with like significantly data-driven insights around the fact that indeed it is the case that people are saying, you know what, this experience has fundamentally changed my barometer, you know, my compass is pointing in a different direction now, right? And you know what? I think that's great. I think that's fantastic. I think that redefining what it is that gives you your why, as Cynic would say, right, is an appropriate conversation to have. I would suggest to you that in many instances, the people who are jumping out of the aircraft pretty confident that they've got a parachute are in the younger demographic of the workforce. I don't think that that's bad. I think that's actually really a positive thing. And I say that, you know, not to sound sort of trite or pandering in that comment. I'm saying it because, you know, the flip side to the story is this is an unprecedented time in the marketplace to be going out and doing 21st century talent spotting, right? Yep. To find the best talent that's available. And I'll tell you, man, I mean, this is a little bit of an off-topic comment, but I would suggest to you that that slogan of the global war for talent is becoming increasingly the case that it's no longer just about company to company. It's now about country to country. And particularly given the dynamics of what's happened with border closures and the rise in nationalism and different sorts of rebalancing of supply chains, manufacturing, et cetera, the countries that have the most favorable environments, policies, circumstances to attract the very best talent are the countries and the governments and economies that are protecting their longer-term sovereignty and security, frankly. And you see this happening, right? Yep. It's like the e-residency programs rolling out from the European Union, particularly Estonia is kind of the benchmark, right? You've got digital nomad visa schemas that are rolling out across the Caribbean and Europe and even here in this region, in Asia Pacific, right? These are going to act as attraction points for the folks who are saying, you know what, my work-life balance is not meeting my expectations in this current role or in this current environment. And because of the impact and advent of remote work, I can actually take this work anywhere I wish to go and perform the tasks that I'm being paid to perform. Now, what's interesting about that is that it's not just about, certainly from my perspective and what my company does, it's not just about sort of moving from one geographic market to another geographic market, meaning country to country. In many instances, the UK, Australia, et cetera, places that have land, right? Instead of concentrating on the labor pool, the talent that's within my backyard environment, what if I could open up to the entirety of the continent? Or
perhaps even more enticing, what if I can make the entire globe my talent pool? Mm. Because I can literally find talent anywhere in the world, and through the right strategy, design, and partnerships, I can tackle that talent, I can hire that talent, acquire. So I think that the great attrition, the great resignation, is a great opportunity. And historically, if you go back to the end of the Second World War, in the United States, there was a huge amount of very talented engineering and scientific labor that was employed around the defense industries, right? And particularly in Silicon Valley and California. And there was a small company coming up at that time. It was called Hewlett and Packard, out of a garage, as the urban lore goes, right? And they made this pivotal decision, which was, as the war effort was winding down and all that labor was kind of being laid off, they decided to go out and pull the trigger and hire that talent.
Yep.
Fast forward even half a decade later, household name, with the best and brightest talent that was possibly available literally on the planet, because they made the prescient decision to invest in talent versus fall prey to what was going on with the economic indicators, which would have said, particularly at that time, that we're going into a recession, right? We're in a war for talent. We're in a war to kind of fight the pandemic. And we're in a war to try and outmaneuver our competition and find the best advantages that we can find. So I think I might have, through my own little bizarre segue, answered both the first and the second question. But tell me if you want to ask another
detail. Yeah, no, I mean, I think as I think about this, right, it's how do companies then grapple with the fact that as a candidate, I have all these options. Right, I have
totally. The power's in the hands of the candidates. Now.
Correct, exactly. 100%. Whether it's country to country, business to business, either way, the question then becomes: is how do then companies think about me as an individual and the experience that I'm supposed to have if I want to choose X brand versus Y?
Yeah.
So how do companies, how do organizations, HR, business leaders need to think about that experience? How do you personalize it to who I am as a person?
So, again, I'll say some things that are going to sound relatively obvious, but you know me, long time, I'm master of the obvious, right? So I would suggest to you that first and foremost, every single person who's listening to this has been a candidate. Even if you've started your own job and you've been a wildly successful entrepreneur and you're the CEO of your firm, at some point you washed dishes somewhere and you had to apply for a job. So you've got to put yourself in the shoes of your user, right? Who's your customer? And the term which is bandied about and perhaps abused is the term empathy, right? You need to do unto others as you would have done unto you. And what is the experience? And frankly, a lot of the customers that I work with, I tell them, you know, mystery shop yourself. You know, put your kid into the mix and let him go through the process. You know, what is it like? Really understand what the people say. How are the dots connected? What's the workflow? I think that's a critical area. The other thing that I would suggest is that I alluded to this a moment ago, but just before the pandemic kind of really gripped, and I would suggest even pre that time, maybe 10 years ago, let's go back in time even further, 10 years ago, the subject matter of virtually every single HR forum in the world was the future of work. Right? The future of work. What is the future of work? What are we going to do in the future? And the reality is that it's always the future of work, first and foremost. And moreover, the hand-wringing sort of nervous refrain that I heard more often than not was particularly the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that the older generations had over the younger generation's expectations coming into the workforce, right? And it was the fact that we were dealing with a, you know, I called it off in the circuit a climax community because you're talking about Generation Z and I hate this word. I don't want to say it. The generation begins with the M generation.
Word,
yeah.
M-word, okay.
And then there was the us, you know, the Xers. And then there are the baby boomers, you know, and all this stuff. And here's the thing that the folks that we're calling the millennial generation, I said it, the snowflakes and the strawberries and all this stuff, right? Because they had such unreasonable and unrealistic expectations. And what were those expectations? Well, they were, I want purpose where I work. I want to be able to set my own schedule. I want to be able to work from anywhere I want to work from. I want to use any device that I want to use. I want to be able to kind of, you know, beyond purpose, I want meaning in the relationships that I have with the people that I work with. And we were all like, you know, you guys with your silly entitlements and all that kind of thing, right? Okay, so now...
Fast forward
a mere 18 months, mm-hmm. right? And now all those expectations that they, by the way, justifiably and rightfully had are table stakes
yeah.
for every single worker in the workforce, regardless of demographic, right? So if you're resisting that now, you shouldn't even be in business, frankly,
Fair
right? Because you're not providing for the type of nurturing, significant environment that's required to attract the very best talent. Mm. And the reality is we spend like 60% of our lives at work. Like it shouldn't be 60% of the problem, right? It should be 60% of the solution
Correct.
To what makes people happy.
Correct.
Psychological safety, agility, resilience, these should be the cornerstones of the new work culture moving forward. They've been reactions. Now they should be proactively designed into the business. And if you get that right, attracting people, I mean, birds of a feather, man. You know, it's not that hard. You get back what you put out.
Got it. Fair point. You talked a lot about the human aspect as it relates to, I would say, lack of better, the softer side of how you find and get the right people in your company. I want to pivot to technology. PwC, in their recent 2021 Global CEO Survey, they talked a little about more than half of the global CEOs are looking at increasing their investments in all things digital, you know, over 10%. But the same survey looked at the investments that they're making in leadership and talent development, and that's a massive lag, between 3 and 8 or 9%, right? And obviously, bonking of the nose. But what this tells me is that leaders, business leaders, HR leaders are continuing to focus on technology, in my opinion, at the potential expense of people.
Mm.
So as you think about that difference between we go in all in technology and people then follow, I just feel that's a massive gap.
Yeah.
Thoughts? I think people are looking at technology saying, this is going to solve for all my travails.
Right.
And forgetting about the person.
Yeah, no, I dig where you're coming from. And let me add a couple of points to that narrative. I think first and foremost, you know, we both come from a background of tech.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my entire career was in technology up until we got wound up in this crazy HR world, right? But the reality is that technology is a tool,
mm-hmm.
right? So if everything looks like a nail, then all you have is a hammer, right? Yeah. So my position on the technology interplay is a couple of fold. In the first instance, I would suggest to you that particularly as it comes to sort of the C-suite, and most certainly within the confines of the HR kind of community,
mm-hmm.
that there's far too much emphasis when it comes to tech on how do we impact the KPIs or the OKRs that are most closely aligned with the assumptions of HR value. So to be more specific, you know, performance management or, you know, some of the more vanilla sorts of aspects. The reality is that, and this is going to sound a little clinical, particularly with the soft and fuzzy stuff I just talked about a moment ago, but there is a dollar and cents component to the impact of HR to the business
mm-hmm.
around productivity, most certainly,
mm-hmm.
but also just by virtue of the fact that singularly, with hardly any variance whatsoever, the most expensive line item in the P&L is the human resources asset,
people,
right?
Yep.
Like the people, the salaries,
the
burden. You know, again, I'm being super clinical here, but that's the most significant impact.
Mm-hmm.
So for HR to be effective in the rollout of adoption of technology that requires significant investment, you need to be able to define the business impact of what this technology is going to do for the overall health of the business. How do you do that? Well, you sit down with the business and bring them into the process, right? So at the end of the day, particularly now, HR has a unique opportunity to kind of be the canary in the coal mine around the investments that are required to digitize the business. It all comes down fundamentally to data,
mm-hmm.
right? And the data that we know we have to have that's accurate is what? It's the employee data,
yep.
because we got to pay them.
Mm-hmm.
We need to know who they are. We need to ensure that we're compliant, et cetera, et cetera. So taking that data into account and building technology strategy around that working with the finance team, working with the IT organization, and by the way, bringing in sales and marketing, et cetera, because at the end of the day, every single organization inside of the company is touched by HR, every single one. So don't do it in a silo. Bring them into the fold, right? Yep. Bring them into the strategy and the design. So that's kind of one. The other piece that I would suggest to you is that the organizations, broadly speaking, need to understand that it is not mutually exclusive or a zero-sum game. That, frankly, if I were to crystal ball gaze for a moment, I would suggest to you that everyone who's listening to this podcast is going to have their work that they do and the work that their robot does. Now, when I say that, it sounds a little bit like I'm high on my own supply, but let me be clear. When I say robot, I'm talking about perhaps if you're in a manufacturing facility, it's a literal, you know, hardware robot. In some instances, what I'm referring to is robotic process automation, right? Yep. Or some machine learning algorithms that are running in the background to augment you. But you're going to be, by default, moving forward, you know, Cognizant back in the 90s coined the two-in-a-box management approach, right? Well, guess what? Everyone is going to be operating two-in-a-box because it's going to be you and your virtual other. And that's just a fact of life. That's going to have such a profound impact on our ability to remove the rote, annoying, degrading aspects of recruitment on the one hand, and put those into a more automated churn of events, right, to produce outcomes that are digestible by the people, and allow the experts, the talent acquisition experts, the HR people, et cetera, to focus on what you just referred to a moment ago, which is the human aspect of this exercise, to provide that touch that everybody wants, right? Particularly now more than ever. They want that human interaction.
Yep. No, great point. No, thank you. I wish more and more organizations don't rely on technology to
solve the problem.
Solve the problem. Well, because it's never going to happen, right? And, you know, you and I have I've worked for, I think, collectively 4 decades in APAC. You've been here for, what, 30-odd years?
36 years,
there
yeah.
There you go.
Jesus.
Long time.
I'm only 38. Okay, moving on.
Moving on. But as you look at the, you know, the 4 decades odd between the two of us, and you know, there are obvious signs. I mean, for example, Southeast Asia, which is our backyard, where we operate and hold very dearly to us. You know, things are beyond the pandemic. I think most Southeast Asian countries are going to be like, you know what, it's time for us to open up, right? If you look at Vietnam, you know, 6.5-7% growth. Singapore has just announced almost a 7% growth. So if you look at whether the factory floors of Vietnam, Malaysia, the barbershop of in Philippines, I'm curious, as you think about organizations or countries opening up and keeping all of that growth in mind, how does the company continue to drive more and more talent coming into the ecosystem? It's a fine balance. You want someone to start to work for you immediately, but then you have this, it's going to get locked down again, or you're going to get shut down again. Just curious, given your experience in APAC, how do you think about, or ASEAN, how do you think about that?
I would look through the lens of a couple of different options to these companies. Number one, I would suggest to you that indeed the opportunities, particularly in Southeast Asia, are going to continue to accelerate, if for no other reason than by virtue of the fact that the trade contest between China and the United States, which has become increasingly acute despite changes in administration, it's still
one-upmanship.
Yeah, I mean, it's not brinksmanship anymore. It's definitely one-upmanship.
Yeah.
And frankly, that's an opportunity, again, you know, for countries who have more favorable foreign direct investment policies and environments in place. So my point being that many companies around the world have come to realize that having an all-in strategy on China as it relates to the supply chain, as an example, is not a scalable option. Now, to be clear, I'm not suggesting that, you know, you walk away from China. It's by any measure, despite my outrageous American accent, as a former American, I can say to you that America, as the number one economy in the world, is either waning to the point of not being true or, frankly, probably isn't true anymore.
Correct.
China is by many stretch, by any stretch.
One.
Well, it's a pretty phenomenal economy.
Correct.
So you're not going to walk away from that. But you need to have a just-in-case kind of strategy, right? And when you put that into the context of some of the trade agreements that are going into ratification progressively in this region, you know, with the UK leaving the European Union, and in December of 2020, which was right around the same time, it was November of 2020 that the RCEP, Regional Cooperative Economic Partnership, was ratified.
Yep.
I shouldn't say that. It was signed, and that's being progressively ratified by the 15 signatories, mm-hmm. of which China's one.
Mm-hmm.
But equally important, you know, UK, which is a phenomenal trading partner to the Asia-Pacific region, is very quickly ratifying trade agreements with a whole host of nations across this region. Singapore mm-hmm. was December. There's $22 billion of trade going on between the UK and Singapore, just as an example, as the sort of the fulcrum to the lever of entering into the ASEAN market, right? So bearing all that in mind, there's a huge amount of interest in foreign direct investment and, frankly, tax revenues mm-hmm. that need to be considered across these regions. So what does that mean? It means that companies are looking for ways and means by which to enter into these markets. And it could be the case that they physically can as these economies start to open up slowly. But regardless of whether they can enter or not, the challenge is going to be how do they tap into the talent pools?
Yep.
And there's a domestic requirement and there's a foreign direct investment requirement. It is indeed the case, and this will sound like a veiled, shameless plug of what I do as a
Go
company.
For it. Go for it, man.
But I just want to call it, let me call it the model. Let me just call it the model. So the model is called the employer of record model, right? And it's a very appropriate model to explore if you're looking for an opportunity to tap into either a market where you're not present, or if you're looking to tap into a talent in a market where you're not present. This is not about low-cost labor arbitrage, right? This is about talent arbitrage. Mm-hmm. This is about, hey, I found the talent in the Ukraine. Is that cost-effective? Maybe, maybe not. But is that the hallmark of what success looks like, or is it gaining the talent, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you alluded to it earlier, it's time to value.
Yep.
The ability to get that talent into market to create the value as quickly as possible. And that's where solutions like what you guys do comes Correct. Into play too, right? Because it's like, how fast can I streamline this process to get this person screened and hired and put into place?
Correct.
And then there's models like what we do, which is how do we ensure that we are able to compliantly hire that individual? And then there are other points in the value chain and the life cycle of that talent as well. But in Southeast Asia, we're at a really interesting sort of crossroads because countries have written significant stimulus checks to keep the economies going,
mm-hmm.
billions of dollars. That money has to be paid back. It's borrowed from the future, right? So the only way to do that, there's two ways. One is foreign direct investment. That's the smart money.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, because that's create jobs, right? And the other way is taxes, mm-hmm. which is the dumb money, because that has a shelf life, right? But you put the two together and it's a positive escalation of the economy. So in order to facilitate that, we've got to put people to work.
Mm.
And, you know, from my point of view, Southeast Asia, with the favorable demographics that we have, you know, for the first time in history, according to Oxford Economics, we are crossing a pivot point where greater than 50%, in fact, the statistic is 56% of the contribution to the global talent pool who are newly graduated from university and ready to work are from the emerging markets for the first time in history.
Mm.
It's no longer the G7, it's the E7, right? Mm. And we're very fortunate in this region to be amongst the E7 yep. in many instances, right? So you've got a super ambitious, technologically savvy, youthful, rising middle-class workforce that's ready to rock. And you've got economies that are just bursting at the seams with ambitious startups. Get in. Get in while you can.
Yeah, fair point. As always, each time I've spent time with you to just talk about just stuff in general, it's been awesome. So thank you so much. You know, as we wrap up our conversation today, I'd love to get your perspective, especially for our listeners today. You know, as organizations think about the humanizing of candidate experience and just bridging that technology versus, I'm going to use the E word, empathy, what advice, actionable insights would you like to give our listeners? How should they think about the crossroads between technology and finding the right people, the candidate experience? Love to get your thoughts on that.
Look, I'll use an acronym that I've been throwing around in a lot of conversations that I've been having recently, and it's the DICE model, mm-hmm. D-I-C-E. And what it means is that redefine your values, your mission, your vision as a firm, and use that as kind of the cornerstone of your philosophy around how you're going to define the roles that are going to impact the future of your business. So once you've done all that, and everyone's got their policies, and everyone's kind of buttoned up and ready to go, when you go out to speak with candidates, what you're looking for certainly is competencies. Granted, those are pretty simple to kind of test for, generally speaking. As a former recruiter, I know that fitness, and not athletic fitness, but the fitness of an individual is the harbinger of success as organizations start to really get serious about hiring. That DICE model that I mentioned stands for determination, it stands for insights, it stands for curiosity, and it stands for engagement. And, you know, we'll use empathy there too, right? And what does that mean? It means that can you have a conversation with a candidate around the concepts of show me a time or express to me an example of where you've shown determination. Determination means overcoming adversity. Now, look, every candidate that you speak with right now should be able to come up with a pretty damn compelling story around how they've overcome adversity, given the circumstances. The insight is about how you take this proliferation, this cavalcade of information that's coming at people now through all these crazy devices and all these channels 24/7 and glean something from all that noise that has value, that is an insight. So can you express a way that you're able to do that, right? And show me some examples, which segues to the C, the curiosity. And that's this insatiable desire to learn and to experience new things. People who thrive in remote environments have that curiosity, that curiosity, that determination, and the ability to get the wheat from the chaff, right? And then that last one, the let's call it the double E, the engagement, the empathy, right? But the engagement is the EQ. So can you express yourself and your intellectual views, but in a way that allows me to feel like I'm being valued and that you respect my opinion, and do that through a screen, right? If you can find individuals that can exhibit those characteristics, my adage, and you know it, I've always said, hire for attitude, train for skill. If you can find those people, you can train them and you can make them the best.
Perfect. Charlie, thank you once again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for the time, man. I really appreciate it as well.